Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Mika Simmons, and welcome to the Happy Vagina podcast. Coming up, we have Nimco Ali OBE, award-winning political activist, CEO of the Five Foundation and leading light in tackling violence against women and girls. A survivor of FGM, Nimco teaches us all about how to be a campaigner and not a complainer. But first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our sponsors. This episode of the Happy Vagina podcast has been brought to you by Day. Day is an innovative gynae health brand on a mission to raise the standards of female healthcare through the creation of sustainable products and services which bridge the gender health gap. Day's naked and CBD tampons are made of 100% plastic-free, certified organic and unbleached cotton fibres. They're sanitised to eliminate bacteria and candida yeast, which are the leading causes of infections like TSS, BV and thrush. Day's CBD tampons have been clinically proven to soothe menstrual pain by 80%. Find out more about the inspirational work of Day and get £5 off your first order with our code THEHAPPYVAGINA at www.yourday.com. That's www.yourday.com. Welcome to The Happy Vagina, a podcast dedicated to celebrating pioneers in the female space who have made a difference in women's health, equality and relationships. Each week, we chat to an inspiring human being as they explore the experiences that completely change their outlook, promising not only to educate, but also entertain and enlighten. And this week, on The Happy Vagina, after much hounding, we have a very, very, very special guest, Nimco Ali OBE. Nimco, if I'd have had it my way, you would have been like my first guest. I mean, you'd have been my pre-guest. You would have been like my pre-guest before the podcast ever even started. Basically, you would have been my co-host if I could have got hold of you a year ago when we launched. But I am so happy to finally have you on The Happy Vagina because you are the vagina queen.
Oh my God, the fanny queen. thank you very much for having me. And ultimately, when I saw your podcast or the name of your podcast, I thought, why the hell have I not been invited onto this?
I had invited you. I was like, does anyone know Nimco Ali? How can I get a hold of Nimco Ali? Somebody, please find Nimco Ali for me. And then, of course, I made some pants that said The Happy Vagina and coming soon. And being like a stylish queen, you discovered me via my knickers. This is true, right?
I literally did. I saw you. I saw a post that was on Albright's website. And I thought, oh my God, how was I not invited to an event that was all about happy vaginas? I'm the vagina queen. I'm the only person that calls herself like the fanny defender of the world.
You are the fanny defender of the world. And you fell in love with my knickers and the rest is history. I have forgiven you. And also, I think, probably Nimco, there's a good reason why I couldn't get hold of you, because I'm just going to read a little short list of your achievements. It's just for fun. It's a little bit like, do you remember that program, This Is Your Life? Do you remember that show when we were kids?
The red book.
Yes. But Nimco, don't you think maybe that me and you should be the new co-hosts of This Is Your Life? It should be like restarted. This Is Your Life. But the way we see it, it could have all like a vagina and female angle on it.
But I'm really interested in getting all the issues about women into the red boxes of Westminster. So that's what I'm going to talk about, the political vagina afterwards. So actually, that could be a really good analogy, talking about the fact that the red book of This Is Your Life into the red box.
Nimco, this is your vagina life. Nimco Ali OBE, this is your vagina life. You are a British activist, co-founder and CEO of the Five Foundation, a global partnership to end female genital mutilation. You are also an independent government advisor on tackling violence against women and girls. You have worked for counter-terrorism within the civil service, supporting the rights of all girls in the UK, and you've led initiatives to end the gender health gap, including co-founding with me the Ginsburg Women's Health Board, and you are the author of a book, What We're Told Not to Talk About, But We're Going to Anyway. There was no swearing in that title, which I thought was amazing, because if it had been, I think you probably would have been like, but we're fucking going to anyway. You were also 2014 Red Magazine Woman of the Year, 2014 number 6 on the Women's Hour Power List, 2018 BBC's 100 Women, 2019 you became Order of the British Empire, OBE, NIMCO, Fanny Ali, 2019 Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy, International Women's Rights Award. And then you are on Debrett's 500 Most Influential People in Britain and the Evening Standard's 1,000 Most Powerful. NIMCO Ali, we do not have time to make This Is Your Vagina Live. You are unstoppable.
I'm weird enough. I've also got a mutilated vagina. So that's the kind of thing. I've got like a very odd vagina. Am I allowed to say this? Do you know what?
You are allowed to say.
I'm going to be very comical about the whole thing about talking about my vagina, because I think humour is better than horror.
I think it's really important to be humorous. And actually, one of the things that I've been looking into while preparing to speak to you was the history of female genital mutilation. And I laughed at some of the reasons why people said they did it. And I didn't laugh because I really think it's funny. I laughed in shock and horror. But I was literally like, some of the explanations historically, which we will come back to talking about the history of it, but that in hot countries, women's clitorises are bigger, that it helps prevent AIDS, that it can stop lesbianism. I mean, this long list of like really, really insulting, awful things that actually, they shocked me so much that I was in a kind of like a weird hysteria around it.
Oh, hysteria is one of the reasons why FGM was carried out in the West and actually still global as well.
Hysteria because masturbation was considered to be something that led women, well, human beings in general, to a form of insanity.
Yeah.
Insanity. So I actually do want to come back to that a bit later, because one of the things that I think is really insulting and misunderstood about FGM is that it's often considered to be, or people that have a lack of understanding or education around it, or who are not open-minded, might think that it is a problem for African nations or Muslim religions. And actually, the truth is that if you really deep look at the history, there is a very serious potential that as a practice, it was started in Britain.
No, I don't think it was started in Britain. It's like there is, in terms of the English context of where the clitoris was first defined or first written about, it was written around the time of the witch trials. And the fact that this, like, you know, this, like, you know, devil-like hook was there. Mm-hmm. And then that led into the clitoris. So basically the clitoris and women have been demonized for millennia, essentially. Mm-hmm. But FGM has been a global issue for the last, I think as since humanity has been around.
A global issue. And I think one of the things that I read, and you may, and there's probably going to be a lot that you'll need to correct me on, but I don't care because I know you love me. And but like, I think I read that it is really a global issue, and that the only place where they hadn't found any history of it is Antarctica. That essentially every single continent in the world has a history of female genital mutilation.
No, definitely. And ultimately, because that's all based in gender inequality and violence against, well, basically male violence against women. So these are basically, the clitoris is there just for the female pleasure. And once you start to actually see women as inferior to men, then you ultimately have to define their sexual pleasure and everything else as inferior to what men need to have. And I think the 18th century, like, you know, really understanding the fact that only the male orgasm contributed to actual procreation, meant that the female orgasm was basically then written out of history and written out of all medical kind of texts. But I think the female anatomy has been something that's actually really been something that's actually, what, the female anatomy has been something that men have always been fascinated by, and men still are fascinated by. So basically controlling that and controlling women's anatomy, control women's pleasure, mm-hmm. is something that has gone through culture and it's something that actually just predates all kind of cultural experiences that we know at the moment.
And the concept that the clitoris didn't really have a purpose is, of course, because only men were allowed to be doctors. And so you said that men have often fantasized about women's bodies because of a lack of understanding. They also didn't really take the time or put the energy into deeply understanding how women's bodies work because of the self-centeredness of human beings in general. Actually, I think human beings in general will often be focused on the thing that is most important for them. But this has led to extreme violence against women's bodies, whether it be literal violence like you've experienced, or, as you know, I believe, the gender health gap, which I really strongly believe that if governments now know about the gender health gap and are not doing anything actively to change the gender health gap and raise women's health up to the same level men are treated, then that becomes violence against women and girls, as far as I'm concerned. Nimco, we've become fierce friends over the last year. You're one of my one of my gifts of the coronavirus, and we've founded this board together to work on closing the gender health gap. And I've really fallen in love with you as a human being, and it's been an honour getting to know you. And I've held back. On a few occasions, I said, I'm not going to ask you that now, because I really wanted to have a first-hand experience with our community about your story. And I know a little bit about it, but really you have built your own empire of fighting for women's rights based on this very early year experience that you had. And can you share with our listeners what happened for you and a little bit about your history?
Yeah, so I am, like, you know, I'm an anti-FGM activist at heart, but also I'm a social, like, you know, I'm a strategist and all these other kind of things. But I was subjected to FGM at the age of 7. And that really was the understanding of my gender for me was actually this act of violence really brought me into my womanhood or girlhood, as you might want to say that. And then I've spent the last 30 years kind of dissecting that and really trying to understand what it means to be a woman and kind of like the gender inequalities that women face, and also how it kind of intersects with every part of our lives. So I think if you'd spoken to me 10 years ago, FGM would have been at the forefront of everything and all that I do. But I think everything and all that I do right now is as a woman who is a survivor of FGM. And so I'm like 38 years old now. So I'm actually 31 years plus my experience of FGM and all my life experiences, period, sex, orgasms, everything else, hopefully pregnancies, and definitely menopause. If I live to the point where I'm able to hit menopause, means the fact that I will be living all those kind of, like, you know, key moments as a woman, as a survivor of female genital mutilation. And that is not a unique thing, because there are 200 million women globally living with that. And somebody once said 20% of all Facebook users are FGM survivors. You could say in that kind of context, it's that's how large the number of women are. So 200 million women globally. And sadly, that could be an extra 70 million by 2030. But I'm working towards that not happening.
So, because you moved to this country from Somalia when you were 4,
So I'm from Somaliland, which is a former British protectorate, so never colony. So we had a massive connection between the UK and Somaliland. So my parents were from Somaliland, Dubai, and were living here in the UK. So yeah, so I basically was here from the age of 4, and then we'd always go back to Somaliland and basically live with my grandparents and kind of just like experience that life. And then basically the civil war broke out when I was there, just when I was about 6 and a half. And then we ended up going to Djibouti in order for us to be able to get back here, because the kind of, we were living here as Somali citizens under the protectorate of being able to live under the UK. So so basically I had to come back to this country at the age of 7 as a refugee.
And at what age were you when you experienced FGM? Actually, before I ask that, I wondered what your first memory of hearing about female genital mutilation. Did you hear about it before it happened to you, or?
No, I had no idea. And this is one of the things why I always say that my FGM happened completely out of context, in the sense that nobody ever talked about it at the time beforehand, at the time or even after. It was just something that happened. And then I was able to really ask a lot of questions about it. So we were in Djibouti, which is another ethnically Somali area of the Horn of Africa, but was a former colony of the French. So I was in Djibouti, and we basically were there with part of my other extended family waiting to come back to the UK, and the FGM happened. And I remember the act itself, and being 7, I still, like, you know, I literally have very vivid experiences and understandings of it. And I still talk about that, and I can really explain those kind of conversations to my sister and to my mom and to everybody else. And it's really interesting when we've been able to have these conversations years later, that it was very kind of vivid. But ultimately, the reality was the fact that my FGM happened, and then I came back to the UK, and I was very much like, what was that? Like, can somebody please really put that into context for me? And because there was no context, I had to go look for context. And I ended up finding the writings of Noelle Adesalawi, who is an incredible Egyptian writer who died last week. And she really vividly wrote about FGM as a form of violence. And what I really understood about that was the fact that how she, for her, it was trying to do that relationship between her and her mom. So she woke up from the hands, and she says that she moved herself out of the grips of the circumciser to try to look for her mom, to try to look for protection, and then saw her mom in the corner basically cackling with all these other women. And for me, when I read that, the only visual context I could have was with Rosemary's Baby, in that kind of thing of like the whole point of this woman that has been in a cult and trying to kind of find their husband, and finding her husband is part of the actual cult that was oppressing her. So that was, so as a child, I was always trying to find understanding about this thing that I had no experience of, no understanding of, and nobody wanted to explain to me. And the kind of pictures that I pulled myself from were, I'm talking about like how it was horrific, how it was wrong. And nobody in my family, thankfully, corrected me and said that wasn't, like, you know, I wasn't going down the wrong route. So they allowed me to actually find my voice in the sense of seeing FGM as something that was wrong, which a lot of people in my community did not actually think at the time.
So that was members of your extended family. But were you able to have that conversation with your mum from quite a young age, or were you more looking around the outside of your immediate family to get some answers?
No, I wasn't able to, because the whole point, I, do you know what, it's taken almost like 30 years to get to the point where I basically was able to understand my mother as a woman, rather than trying to expect things from her. She was 27 when I was subjected to FGM. And for me at 27, I was actually completely a baby. I'm 38 now. So I'm 11 years older than she was. And to be able to say that I would have the power and the voice to stand up to a patriarchal community at that age is actually something that I know would never have happened. So the way that I dealt with my mom was actually, I was demanding an apology and demanding an explanation from her that she could never give me. But what she gave me was the ability to be able to be educated and to have the freedom that I do now, to be in the position that where I am, to understand not just FGM as for what it is, but to be able to fight against it. So I was never able to have a conversation with my mum until about a few years ago. But I actually didn't have the conversation in a way that I thought I would have. But I interestingly met Noelle in 2014, and I really wanted to ask her about her relationship with her mom and how they really rebuilt that, because I was struggling with my relationship with my mom at the time. Before that, I was listening to her talk, and she kept talking about how she'd written the passage about FGM, which really changed my life as a 12-year-old. I remember reading that. I was 12. So the FGM that I had was very invasive. It's called infibulation FGM. And then I came back to the UK. So at the age of 11, I had to have medical intervention, which because of the fact that I had really severe complications as a result of that. So I went and found information for myself. And she talked about how embarrassed she was to write that out, like, you know, to write that piece, and how she'd written, how she ripped it up and thrown it into the Gulf of Aden several times. And I thought, like, you know, I've been sitting here from the age of like 11 all the way up to the point where I was in my mid-20s, wanting to ask Noelle, how did you rebuild that relationship with your mom? My question ended up being, what were you scared of when you kept... So on the platform, she said, I was scared to put that essay out. I ripped it up. And she replied back, she said, I was scared of being reduced down to nothing but a mutilated vagina. Because she's like, I'm a doctor, I'm all these things. Like, I'm a freedom fighter, I'm a political activist. To be seen as anything, just to be seen just as an FGM, like survivor, or a victim at the time, is like, she said, that's what really was scaring me. And I thought, that's what kept me silent for years and years as well. It's the idea, the fact that I would be reduced nothing but a mutilated vagina.
For any woman who chooses to speak out about something as dramatic and wrong and violent as FGM, it will become the fulcrum that things start to pivot around. It's just the nature of your work in the public space once you become publicly talking about that. And I know that you work really hard to make sure that your lessons from that also are reflected in other areas of violence against women, but you've talked a lot so far about this being a patriarchal system. You know, this action of FGM that you are subjected to is wrapped up in that it's a cultural, historical thing that we do for you know, that's part of a culture, that it's tradition, and of course it's not, and it mustn't be. And it has stemmed from the male psyche of trying to repress women, trying to repress women's sexuality, trying to repress. I read somewhere that sometimes it was thought that if the clitoris was too long, then that woman would have too much sexual energy. All of these things are really vile and disgusting. The thing that I find really moving about what you've just talked about is that, and I still find it really moving now, is that it is the women within the communities. So another thing that I read was that a young woman was told, this is something special for women. And I feel so deeply, deeply sad, Nimco, that something that was imposed on our gender then got taken into the female community and became something that became secret for the women. To me, That's possibly one of the most devastating parts of the journey, is that it became something that the women were doing to the women, even though the men started it.
No, it's not even just the men started, the men still benefit from it. So the whole point is the fact that if women started saying, so if my grandmother was as loud as I am today, she'd be dead. Therefore, my mother would never be born and I would never be born. So the whole thing is that the revolution has to start by pushing one generation before, like, you know, forward to the next. So the reality is the fact that there is no other existence or no kind of way for women to exist without being married in the continent of Africa at the moment, is the fact that there's no economic justice, there's no economic empowerment for women. And these men then would only say, we'd only marry women that are cut. So either the women make it into something that they have to celebrate, and they have, because it is this thing,
Right.
It's basically it's the same okay. shit. I'm gonna say it's the same shit as when you tell your daughter not to put her above head above the parapet about not being too loud at school, not being too, all these things. So the whole point is that women are conditioned to the point of the fact that once you do something like this, then you basically get a punch in the face. So then what a mother does is the fact that how do I protect my daughter from being punched in the face? It's the fact that I need to condition her to the point where the fact that she knows that this is the space that she needs to inhabit. And within my culture, within my community, there are stories that are told about the perfect mother, the perfect woman, all these other kind of things. Even in our society, like I keep saying to people, like, you know, who is the hottest girl that you like? What like, if I say to men, what does an incredibly hot woman look to you? They will announce, they will talk about people they will never meet, but those are the people that the media put out there. So the same way that the media tells us to pluck our eyebrows, color our hair, do all these things, it's the same way where FGM and all these things are perpetuated within in those communities. So what my mother did was the fact that she had no control over, and it literally took for me to, she had no control over me not being cut. She could say, I'm not going to cut my daughter, but I don't understand. I don't know what would have happened after that. What she did was the fact that I don't have I don't have the power not to cut my daughter. And she didn't tell me that. She did what she had to do. And then she gave me the leverage and the opportunities to be freely educated. Never to tell me that FGM was okay and it was great, but just also just give me the, like, she literally fought the patriarchy of Somali men and Somali community here, even in the West, in order for me to become who I am, to the point where I can stand today and say to my niece, who, so my grandmother was, had a early child, like forced marriage. My grandfather was like, I'm not going to consummate that until she's 18. So my grandmother was given as a child, was illiterate, had FGM. My mother was educated, still had a forced kind of marriage, and FGM. But so basically, she had the education. So I only had FGM, not the marriage. And I have a niece now, the fourth generation, that doesn't have FGM, doesn't, is freely educated. If she gets married, she might, I don't know to who, to whatever. So the whole point is the fact that it is not about women, like, you know, really gaining this thing. I'm thinking, like, it's amazing, it's women having no choice but to say, fuck, this is part of our lives. How do we teach, how do we not let ourselves break when we're doing that? So there has to be a level of, like, so I learned that I forgave my mom rather than demanding forgiveness from my mom. So that's what I was doing for years and years. I was like, I want you to apologize. And we, I am in a position that my mom will never ever be. I'm so beyond FGM that it doesn't actually it doesn't actually have a role in my life. Like, I would always have the scars, but it doesn't actually impact my life. Like, I don't know puberty before FGM. I don't know all these other things before FGM. Like, I'm living as Nimco as I am. It doesn't define me. It doesn't, like, I've never thought of it as part of my life. So, yeah, so the whole point is we can't actually be in this space where we're saying the fact that African women are embracing this and, like, oppressing it. They have no choices, and we have to be able to, that's what I do through the Five Foundations, actually give these women, I've never, ever met an African woman, which is where FGM is the most concentrated, is a global issue, but it's the most concentrated, that's ever wanted to do FGM. I've met women that don't have choices. And when they're given choices, they would give them to their daughters before they would give it to themselves.
Many of the women that I read about were too frightened to give their names, because one of them actually said, I think this was in a documentary, I cannot give my identity because my sons will kill me. And I think, I mean, I'm sure that is possibly one of the most extreme responses. However, I think women like Noella and you putting your head, I mean, it's an amazing kind of analogy to compare it with women not being too loud. But Nimco, I always have a moment when I feel really emotional. It's really amazing. I get it. And I really appreciate you using that analogy to explain it, that the lack of freedom is the same. It's the same it's the same repression of women. It's the same, how can we keep women from being the really phenomenal powerhouses that we are, whether it be shush, be quiet, you're a girl, or whether it be through female circumcision. It is all the same. The root is the same.
It's not circumcision. It's actual mutilation. It's actual brutality. Like, I don't agree with male circumcision, but like the consequences and the realities are completely different, because what you get as a woman when you are like cut, and when FGM is commissioned on you, is you get more oppression. When foreskin is removed, men get the keys to the kingdom. So to call it circumcision is actually to call it a celebration. There's nothing to celebrate about what happens to women. And it's like, it might, like, I can only speak for my culture, my community, and I also know other women and the way that they're kind of like, you know, extremely chastised, and it's kind of linked to what it, like, honestly, economic opportunities and choices. Women, like, the, like, I've never met a woman that has a choice, that has actually chosen FGM. And that is the main thing. It's like, there is literally, choice is the most fundamental thing when it comes to FGM.
And one of the quotes that I read about you was, and I'm gonna quote you back to you, Nimco.
Go on.
I love this. When I see my niece and that her life has been uninterrupted, it's the most beautiful thing. And sometimes I'm jealous of her being a 9-year-old that lives this innocent kind of life. And, you know, you just said that you live free of FGM now, in the sense that it's not the fact that you pivot.
I said I live beyond FGM.
Okay, you live. Okay.
I can never be free of it because it's part of my life, but yes. I live beyond it.
I know, but the thing is, Nimco, is about you, is that you have no self-pity. And that is really, when someone's been through the level of trauma that you've been through, because when the FGM that you had started to give you very serious complications, Nimco, you could have died.
Yeah.
You almost died. You were ended up in hospital.
Yeah.
And so you're, you know, I think you're very humble, Nimco, and I know that Twitter doesn't always think you are, but personally I find you one of the most humble human beings ever, because Nimco, the lack of self-pity that you have around this, and I don't think you can see clearly, Nimco, just how amazing it is, the work that you're doing. I sometimes think you're so far inside of it that you actually don't really understand how mind-blowingly phenomenal it is that you have decided to speak out so bravely and so openly about this. Because I was at a talk once about FGM a few years ago, and there was a woman in the audience who was literally trying to defend it as a cultural right, you know, and this was a lawyer. So the only reason I raise that is because that's in the UK. And I understand that FGM does happen in the UK, but I think really what I'm trying to say is thank you.
But honestly, it's really weird. So the whole point is, like, there are two types of people that kind of defend it. People who've had it, who can't actually deal with the experience of it. Because sometimes I think the whole thing is that you can be beyond FGM. FGM can always be, like, you know, you can stay in this victim mentality. You can kind of, that's like, you know, it's like, I will never say to a woman that you're not allowed to feel bad about the experience that you've had. But what it is, it's the fact that we have a system of so-called activism, which is not actually achieving anything. That means that you constantly stay in this space, the fact that you're talking about your trauma. And we do that to a lot of women, to a lot of white working class women, a lot of African women, a lot of, like, you know, South Asian women. So you're always dealing with your trauma. Rather than being able to be allowed to be beyond your trauma. And I was there, I was always talking about, I'd also kind of say, like literally, I am who I am. The whole point is the fact that there are things that trigger me, and I'm not going to go into a space. I can be beyond that. I can, like, you know, how do we end FGM? I can also exist as an FGM survivor, as someone that carries the wounds of FGM, but not defined by it. And that's the fundamental thing, is the fact that the FGM that happened to me does not define me, and I don't identify with it as my own definition of who I am. But there are people who are put into that box. And then what happens when they're put into that box? It's like the people are putting them in that box are progressives that want them to constantly come out. So when I'm standing here going, guys, like, fuck FGM. Let's talk about life beyond FGM, and let's talk about ending FGM, and let's talk about women existing. Mm. That is what it is. And then when I was growing, and then at the same time, there are people that say, when I was talking about FGM, say, why are we talking about it? Because that doesn't identify me. So, like, the reality is the fact that the people that defend FGM are two people. People who are so progressive, they're racist, that they kind of like are sitting there going, like, you know, oh, why are we talking about, like, why should we end FGM? It's a cultural practice, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, it's a human rights violation. Mm. And then the second set of people are people who are so, like, identifiable with it, like, as victims, as survivors, as people that are in it, that they just can't, that they just haven't been able to step outside of it. So when I start talking about, I always say it's like reading your, like, your diary in the middle of a sixth form common room. You want to strangle the person reading your, like, your diary, rather than wanting to laugh about all the stupid things that you write as a 16-year-old. Mm. So a lot of people are actually in that space where they're still in the common room. Mm. And some of us are out of it. So, yeah, it's like, it's hard to say to people, you can be an FGM survivor beyond it. I can talk about my experience. Mm. I was cut at the age of 7, almost died at 11, and then was dismissed for years and years, and then really got into this space where I politically wanted to campaign about it. Mm. And now I live in a space where I'm almost 40, when I can say, yeah, I had FGM, but what the fuck, I've also done other things as well.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh.
So what was the, like, what was the transition for you in terms of building a sense of okayness with your past and your body? So really what I hear you saying is that you've transitioned into the now, that you live in the present. You don't live in your past, you don't sit in your trauma, that you are free to a certain extent. And I think, being an activist myself, actually the affirmation of using my traumas and my losses to make change has been very healing and definitely part of my journey of becoming the woman that I am today. And I'm proud of the woman that I am today. And it's partly to do with the work that I do for women, based on my loss and my personal traumas. Do you, you just said, you know, you decided to get political when you decided to do some activism around FGM. Do you have any fundamental moments where you remember thinking, oh, I'm starting to feel differently about this? I mean, really personally, Nimco, where rather than feeling traumatized, you went, oh, I feel like something's changing inside of me.
So honestly, I got into activism as a default. It wasn't something that I intended to do. So I'll also acknowledge the fact that because I had my medical intervention so young, I had all my lived experiences as a woman, like my first orgasm, my period, and everything else, post the the medical intervention of FGM. So I could have, had I grown up in a family that didn't necessarily empower me to the position that I was, if I never got married, I could be sitting here right now with an infibulated anatomy. So basically my anatomy is stitched up. I'm very happy to say, like, you know, I started my period today. So my first period came with a vagina that was open and it wasn't infibulated. So the whole point is the fact that I did not necessarily have as much of the experiences that a lot of the girls that in my community did, who also growing up here, who also most of them, some of them were born here. Most of us were here since we were like, you know, three or four. So basically spent most of our lives in this country. But like my activism came from a sense of guilt, because I knew when I started to see Somali girls, like I came into my adulthood, into my like, you know, early 20s from a space of the fact that not meeting anybody that has had FGM, because I literally like rejected, like, well, basically just like stopped talking to my Somali friends, just like lived in a world where everybody was non-Somali and everybody was very Caucasian and those are the kind of things. And then when I first of all, then when I connected with Somali young people and then the community outside of my own family, the first thing that actually came to me was FGM. And I was just thinking like, why is this still a thing? Because I thought I left that when I was 13, 14. And then it was my, and then I literally look, I remember looking and thinking, my silence is so complicit to the misunderstanding, because people would always, I'd be in my very well-meaning liberal white friends' houses talking about FGM from an anthropological kind of context. And I'd be like, I would never say anything, because I was just thinking like, I don't want to be that mutilated vagina. I don't want to. So I was always talking to third person. I would, I would say, but do you not think it's a form of violence against women and girls, Trevor? So I literally was
there really someone there called Trevor?
No, there wasn't. I've never actually hung around with a Trevor, but it,
I've got a Trevor I can introduce you to, Nimgo. So you say, don't you think it might be a form of violence rather than speaking about yourself and your personal experience?
Yeah, so I would always speak in a third person, and they would always be called Charlie or Stephen or whatever. Anyways, it was very kind of middle class and white and North London and all those other kind of things. And I'd be like going like, you know, okay, that's not really how it is. And I would literally, I'd also even in civil service write comments on things saying, should we not look at this, but without actually saying anything, saying that this relates to me. And I actually hadn't seen that passive aggressiveness until I met a young Somali girl who objected to, when I was doing something about the violence against women and girls stuff years ago, before the stuff that I'm doing now, and wrote something to one of the ministers that I was working with. And I thought, you know what? I hear you. You don't want to be the girl in the office where everybody looks at saying, oh my God, have you had FGM? Because that's the kind of problem. It's the fact that, like, you know, it's fine to think about FGM as being my auntie's issue, but it was also my issue, and it was also my very Western issue. It was very much a woman that speaks English with an accent, speaks like, you know, works around the kind of, but also I wasn't being a victim. I was, I'm gonna tell you, I'm a fucking survivor. Let's go beyond the FGM kind of thing. So but the reality is that I came across the young girls in Bristol, and I came across the young girl in London, and I was like, my silence is so complicit to this, but I also have a platform and a privilege and an understanding of how to change policy. That's why all the work that I've done on FGM has been political, because it's about the state, it's about the UK protecting my niece, protecting, like, it never put, like, I came back as a 7-year-old and told my teacher, I spoke perfect English. I was like, miss, this happened to me. And she's like, I don't know. And then when I was in hospital, I was 11 years old. I was in a fucking major NHS hospital. They saw my anatomy and they could have said, shit, this is aggressive. This is horrible. Let's actually see if, like, you know, what's going on. They didn't, they chose not to do that because they thought brown girls did not actually we're not deemed to have the same.
It's child abuse.
Exactly.
Child abuse.
But I was too brown to be protected. And I thought, when I got to a position, I was thinking, I'm not going to talk to my mom about FGM, because my mom is probably not going to do it. I'm like, that's not the point. I don't want to talk to, like, the Somali community, the Sierra Leone community. I want to talk to the fucking government and say, listen, you guys have the right to say, if British children need to be protected, let's protect them. And that's what we're going to do. So my work has always been about protecting British girls against FGM, because the whole point is, we care, you're part of this country. So if I had not been as successful as I am now, and I'd kind of died or been killed by the people that hated me for doing the work that I was doing, my niece would be protected by the law. So if my sister-in-law is going to take my niece away now, she'd be asked, if she's taking her back to Somaliland, she'd be asked, are you going to have FGM done to her, blah, blah, blah. No, those are questions that are going to be asked. My niece is now part of this UK, the UK government's legislation, and she's protected. And that's all I've ever wanted, was to be seen as a British child, because that's all I was. From the age of fucking 4 years old. Well, from the age of 4, I was living in the UK, but from the age of 7, I was technically a British child and I should have been protected.
Well, one of the things about you, Nimco, that I have found most enlightening and helpful amongst all the things is this idea of, I've really integrated it, that actually, unless you change policy, nothing really changes. So for all the campaigning, we're grateful to the people out on the streets making the noise, but actually you have to change it at government level. And you said that your focus was trying to create a world where period poverty doesn't exist, where FGM or forced marriage isn't a reality anymore. And you are definitely, you know, a huge part of the tribe of humans that are really making that a fact nowadays. You are also therefore heavily involved in politics and government. And I would say, of all the women that I know in my life right now, and this is an impressive thing for me to say, okay? Of all the women that I know in my life right now, you live as your own woman more than any of them. And I find it super inspiring. It does mean that you are often kind of on the rock face, and you do get a bit of flack, I would say. I think people, that you are brave enough to have an opinion, and you're fierce with your opinions, and you're right. You're morally right with your opinions as well. So therefore they need to be heard. But I just wondered, you know, how is it for you, Nimco, that you seem, I feel like you're a bit misunderstood sometimes. Do you feel like that?
Do you know what? So my new piece, the piece that I have in life, is the fact that people... No, but the whole was like, I'm not misunderstood. People intentionally misinterpret everything I say.
You think they're doing it on purpose?
Yeah, they definitely do on purpose. They definitely do on purpose because it makes them feel better that that they want to be able... So it's the same reason as like the fact that I always say, like, the reason what I did with my mum, I did that with my mum. I was expecting things from her. I was expecting perfection from her, because that's what you do from mums. And I looked at my mum as a woman and I thought, okay, you know what? We're all flawed as human beings. This is how we kind of work. So the opinions that I have are always informed. Like, I don't have an opinion about everything. Like, when people, I get the media thing, oh, can you come talk about Meghan Markle? And I'm like, I don't know her. And I don't really I don't have an informed opinion. I can have a knee-jerk reaction to things. But I just think that's what I'd say to my friends on whatever it was. Or that's what I would have tweeted like 10 years ago. But now I understand that, like, you know, people want to kind of be... So the whole point is, like, everything that I talk about or I say something on is informed and there's a basis on it. So it's like, you know, the things I have opinions on are informed. So when I get like really aggy about people not listening to me, I used to, I'm not anymore, it's because of the fact that I'm like, I've researched these things. Just so, like, you know, feelings are not facts. I have a lot of feelings about a lot of things, but like things I want to talk on, I need to have facts on. Yeah, so I am like, the whole point is like the reason why I'm misunderstood, or some people misunderstand me, is because they work towards that. They've never actually asked me a question, and anything that I've read, they actually don't disagree with, but they just have never expected that of a woman of color. So it's about their insecurities that, like, you know, so I'm basically challenging their insecurities rather than actually me really saying anything that's wrong. So I'm now in this position where I'm feeling very, like, one of my friends says, she's like, you seem a lot happier, a lot lighter. I'm like, I'm in this position, like, I said what I said and I mean what I mean. So I actually don't care about trying to please people who are intentionally misunderstanding me.
Well, intentionally misunderstanding you for the very same reason that you spoke of at the beginning of this conversation,
because they don't like loud women.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's exactly the same thing. And unless you just go, I mean, I've been doing it a lot this year. I'm taking no prisoners this year. If someone does something that isn't okay for me, morally or ethically, rather than spend a week ruminating on it in my head, I take it up with them straight away. I've been like clearing through stuff because I think that smallness that we can have as women, Limco, that kind of like, oh, let me just go and talk to a few female friends about what's going on first, rather than trust your gut instinct, get your facts. I love what you just said, that feelings aren't facts. Thank you for reminding me. I should have that like tattooed somewhere. But you get your facts straight and then have an opinion, and you don't need to go and talk to your girlfriends over a bottle of wine about it first. You can just have an opinion. Men would never not have an opinion. They wouldn't go and chat to like 10 mates.
I wanted to Instagram something yesterday, because I thought, you know, I'm not going to tweet it because like I'm always finding different platforms have different meanings. But I thought, you know what, are you an adult unless you spent like, you know, $2,000 on a media lawyer trying to get somebody to retract something that you never gave them like, you know, permission to actually say? 10 years ago, or like the last 10 years, I've given so much of my own time to kind of like, people like, oh, it's so powerful, let's hear about it. And I'm like, literally, the reason why my mother and like, you know, my sister and the people that I love and I had like such a turmoil relationship over the last 10 years is because of the fact that I've given too much of myself in order to educate people about FGM and all these other kind of things. Mm. And I'm like, I don't need to use my personal struggle in order for me to actually understand. Like, I'm actually an expert in what I talk about. I didn't wake up yesterday and say, oh, I'm going to end violence against women and girls. I've been actually actively fighting against male violence for like 10 years. Mm. So it's just like, there are
just be like, here's my book. When people come at you, just be like, here's my book. Here's my book. Here's my book.
The whole thing, but they know, but that's what I mean. They know.
They're being contrary. People like, especially, I mean, we've kind of started talking about, it's my fault. I've led you down somehow or other. We're in a social media rabbit hole, and we're not even currently on social media. We're in a Zoom room. But I mean, really, it makes me cross to see people to kind of come at you on social media, because knowing you like I do, I feel that you are a woman of immense, immense integrity. I find you unbelievably well, thoroughly researched and thought out in everything that you do. And I think the other thing that I have really learned from you is the ability to move outside of politics. So my background is my family. We have a long-standing relationship with left-wing politics, and I would still consider myself to be part of that thinking. However, when it comes to women's bodies and violence against women and girls, there is no time or business to be involved in that kind of minimalistic politics, like who you vote for. There's no space for it, Nimco. And you've like risen up and outside of that. And I think that's one of the reasons that people find you so challenging and also try and put you down, is because because you've moved outside of the divisiveness. You're not interested in the divisiveness. You're not going, I'm on this side or this side. You're just going, this is right and this is wrong. And we need to get to what's right. We need to get to what's right for women. We need to get to what's right for girls. And we need to look for solutions and make change. Stop fighting. Just get on with it and make the changes that need to happen in order for this country and the world to be a safe place for our gender, you know. And I watch you on a daily basis work your ass off. Your very gorgeous bottom.
My front bottom, my vagina off. Like, I work my family off. Yeah, honestly, I do. I literally think, do you have the power in order to change things? Then I'll work with you and I'll have a conversation with you. And also, it's always very, I think it's easy for me to cross over and have common ground and have common conversations with people. And my ex used to say the main thing, that like one of my greatest skills in life is good chat. I can just chat to anybody. I'm like, what up?
You've got good chat. You're also so funny.
And because I don't take myself fucking seriously. It's like people just take themselves so seriously.
Well, you take the right things seriously, though, Nimble.
No, but no, I do serious things. I want to make shit happen.
Yeah.
But I don't take myself seriously. I'm like, come on, guys, let's just try. I said to one of my friends the other day, I said, I'm a campaigner, not a complainer. Like, I could sit here every day, like all day, every day.
My God, I love it. I'm totally going to call this episode that. Not the complainer.
I just literally, I complain about so many things, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to campaign. I'm going to change things. I'm going to be like, impact, change. Yes. What the fuck are we going to do?
Yes. And on that note, Nimco, we are coming towards the end of my time with you. Actually, cool. That's a lie. We're coming towards the end of the community's time with you. I get to speak to you all the time, but I want to speak to you about what still needs to happen around what would you like to see in the next year? And then the next 5 years in terms of violence against women and girls, what are the key things that you want our community on The Happy Vagina to be making noise about, reading about, learning about, being educated about and telling everyone about?
Sadly, by the time this comes out, the violence against women and girls strategy would have closed. But ultimately, it's about actually conversation. I think the key thing is conversation. We have a broken social contract. I think so the whole point is that I believe that it's both men and women that need to be able to engage in order for us to end violence against women, well, male violence against women and girls. And we have to be able, so the government is going to be the foundation. So someone said to me the other day, you don't need to wait for MPs to legislate. Yes, legislation is key. Legislation is the principal factor in terms of what the social contract foundations is. This is how we're meant to behave. And then after that, we're meant to do the work. So what I want your community to talk about is the fact that we all have a role to play. Like each and every one of us has the role to play in terms of ending male violence against women and girls. Like men are not born as as violent men. We educate them. And there's this whole conversation about educating boys. Let's educate men as well. Let's have conversations. Let's talk about real like forgiveness and real like honesty about the men that have hurt us. And we were just talking about that before. There are men that are in our lives who probably hurt other women. There are other men who have hurt us. And let's have these truth and reconciliation. If we want to forgive, we forgive, but it is not our position to say how another woman should feel. There's two things. If a woman wants an historical act of violence to be prosecuted, I support you because fundamentally I believe you. And if I love that man, I can also work with him to see what happens and how he kind of reacts to that. So I think the real work that needs to be done is for us as adults to understand that there is redemption in the conversations, in the conversations that we need to have. So there is working towards redemption and really working towards being honest with each other. And if you want to forgive, we can forgive. If you don't want to forgive, then that's fine. So really just actually looking at the understanding of the fact that each and every one of us owns our stories and owns the ability for us to feel how we want to feel about men who've hurt us and how we want to work towards achieving a world where there is real violence and violence against women ending.
So more honest communication, more honest conversations between women about actually what their true experiences are. And also what I just got from what you just said deeply reflects everything about what you are, because you're saying, let's not blame the male gender for the violence against women from men. You're saying, but if you need to do something at legal level, then do it, which is the same as making change at policy. So actually, this inner world that you're talking about now, about what we should be doing, boots on the ground women, very much reflects your activism, which is honest communication, aligning with a much higher moral code. And if you need to take action to prosecute, then get some help with that and find out from someone in the legal profession whether or not that's something you can do.
Yeah, no, definitely. So the point is, like, if you're kind of like the healing process for you means that you want to be able to talk about your experience of violence and that person is in the public sphere or wherever, don't actually allow. So the whole point is that sometimes holding a mirror up to the wrong that men did. They maybe help them or whatever it is. So don't start saying the fact that, oh, he's a family member, it was 20 years ago, it's whatever. If you need to report it, if you want to report it, you have the power to do that. And I fundamentally want to be in a space that the fact that I believe every single woman, it's like I'm in that kind of space. It's the fact that, so that's what I mean about truth and reconciliation, is the fact that we have to have spaces. We have to say that 50% of this population in this country, women, live a complete different quality of life to the other, because the fact that we fear the ones that we love. So when we're walking the streets, our experience is different to when men are walking the streets. And that's because some other man that we know has done something to us, but that man could also easily be you. So the reality is, let's have real conversations, and let's really build a community and a country and a contract against us about honesty, saying like, so a list of people who did things. Okay, that's what we did. How do we deal with that? This basically, maybe even saying those things out loud makes things better. But the whole point is like, so I just think,
look for the solutions. Like, let's move towards the solutions for it.
Exactly. Let's have a conversation about the fact that, like, rather than feeling bad about all the men that did us wrong, let's actually have a conversation about it. Because I know there's a thing about people saying, like, you know, you're following my abuser, let's unfollow him. It's not about unfollowing him, it's about actually naming him and actually letting him do the work. So we need to actually be able to put men in a space where they need to do the work, because the reality is, there are some men that are born that way and there are some men that are educated that way, but we have to be able to have honest conversations in order to filter that out. And then that means the next generation of men know better and do better, because this idea of the fact that we need to educate boys, boys haven't committed any crimes yet. Some of them, most of them haven't. Men have committed crimes. You are the one that we're scared of. You're the ones that we're being. So it's those kind of conversations. So it's just the same thing as like the fact that if I was not cut, I would not be married. This thing would happen to me. We all think like, you know, if we don't go out at night, if we don't do these things, like we're literally physically, mentally or socially mutilating ourselves on a day-to-day basis.
Nimco, every time I speak to you, I learn something exceptionally brilliant and slightly new. And I've been banging on social media about educating boys, even though I am child-free. And now I'm going to start banging on about educating the men, and I will tag. I'll be like, stolen from the queen. That is Nimco Ali.
You know what? Can you say that? Because I wanted to tweet it, and I thought, you know what? Can I deal with the hassle? So my new thing is that I'm actually so grown up. The fact that I'm like, do you know when those things? I'm like, no. So I've got so many.
Ah, restraint of pen and tongue. Oh my god, Nimco, that's so grown up. You must be almost 40.
I'm almost 40. I'm like 18 months away from it. It's like shocking. I'm just going to say, it's the fact that it is men. Men is what we need to be able to.
Because also in a family unit, if there is a traditional male and female role, let's just say, it's often the dad that the boy's going to look up to. So what are we talking? What also, like, why are we again getting the mums to tell the mums to train their sons? Hang on a second. Yeah. Get the dads to train the boys. Nimco, I love you, and I'm so grateful for your time. Everybody that's listening, go and follow Nimco Ali, because she is one of our greatest revolutionaries. Greatest, really, truly greatest. Also has great chat, very funny, and has got a wonderful, wonderful book that you should all go and buy and read, called
What We're Told Not to Talk About, But We're Going to Anyway.
What We're Told Not to Talk About, But We're Going to Anyway. Nimco Ali, thank you for being our guest on The Happy Vagina. This has been an exceptional episode. Have an amazing day. And a very special thank you to our partners of this week's episode, Day. Day's cramp-soothing CBD tampons are proven to reduce menstrual pain by 80% in clinical trials. Find out more about the inspirational work of Day and get £5 off your first order with code THEHAPPYVAGINA at www.yourday.com. That's www.yourday.com. I'm gonna sit to play on fire. In love.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.